Been talking about the story of the Buddha, which is a time-tested traditional way actually of talking about what the values and insights of Buddhism themselves are. So you know that Buddha was born in India, actually in just inside what is now the Nepali border, the Lumbini Gardens. And he's called the Buddha, as we said last time, because he awakened. Bud, the Sanskrit root Bud, means to awaken. And sometimes he's referred to in English as the enlightened one, as if something kind of happened to him and he got enlightened. I think the word awakened is very significant because, you know, when you wake up from sleep, it's something that comes from within. There's something that arises from within and becomes more apparent to you. Oh, I was dreaming. Oh, this is where I actually am. Oh, I see. Now I understand. It's a very intimate kind of experience. And so the Buddha awakened, and what he awakened to and how he awakened and why we should want to similarly awaken is really the pith of understanding what Buddhist traditions and literature are all about. So what was the Buddha doing there? We said last time that there was a kind of meeting of the celestial beings in one of the great heavens. And it was determined, the Buddha determined that he really ought now, after he had been practicing and honoring other enlightened beings for 72,000 kalpas for a long, long time. And this already tells us something. He became a Buddha because he was able to honor something that is central to the experience of becoming awakened. He honored other awakened beings. And that is why traditionally, particularly in Buddhist temples of a later tradition, we have many images you see here of enlightened Buddhas. There's more than one. Shakyamuni Buddha was the historical Buddha. But in the Buddhist tradition, particularly in the tradition that develops later, about 500 years after the Buddha's birth, it's believed that there are infinite Buddhas. Infinite. They're all over the place, everywhere, actually. And we, too, are invited and encouraged. And in fact, it is assumed that we, too, can become awakened. And that's what it means to become a Buddha. So this, our Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, determined that he would descend now into the womb of his mother, Maya. So this is portrayed in all the stories of the Buddha as a very conscious decision. And it's a kind of offering to the world also, because you may remember last time in many of the stories of the Buddha, they say that none of the other would-be, could-be Buddhas wanted to come to this world. It was considered particularly problematic and kind of like a hardship post, you know. but Shakyamuni, the one who we now know as Shakyamuni Buddha, I'm going to go. And everyone was delighted. All the heavenly beings praised him. And so we see this moment in the Buddha's decision to descend, to come down to our world in order to benefit the people in this world, the beings in this world. So right away, we see that compassion is the motivation of the Buddha for coming into this world. And the day of the Buddha's descent is celebrated in the Buddhist tradition. So Buddha descends. He enters his mother's side. Maya, she has a glorious dream of a white elephant entering her side, and she has no pain and no difficulty. And when he's born, he takes seven. He's fully clothed when he's born, and he takes seven steps. And he declares various things in different versions of the tale. In one of the most classic, he says, "I have come here to benefit all beings. That's why I'm here. In this life, I'm going to actually complete my process as a Buddha." Now, this statement and this kind of pageantry, because in fact, in his lifetime, he does go through stages of practice, and become a Buddha. And the question that develops later in the tradition, later in conversations about the Buddha, is what exactly was really going on? Was he just an ordinary person when he was born there in Lumbini Garden? And then through his great effort, his great meditation, his very good karma, which he had accumulated through countless previous lives of practicing, actually, developing virtue, doing kind things, giving his body, famous story, he gives his body to the mother tiger because her little ones are going to starve. She doesn't have milk for them. This is in a place called Namo Buddha, very exquisitely beautiful place in Nepal. These are known as the Jataka tales. They're wonderful children's stories, actually, the birth stories, the 500 pure and 500 impure births that the Buddha had. And in the pure births in particular, he did acts of great generosity, saving lives. Once he was a turtle and carried many, many beings, small like bugs from the sea, onto the shore. And he realized that if he were to go back in the ocean and wash them off, they would die. So he just let them be, and eating him. In other words, there was nothing too much that to be done to benefit beings. And this was his modus operandi. This was his focus. So in the early traditions of Buddhism that immediately followed the Buddha's birth in India, it was felt that he was, in fact, an ordinary person just like us and was, you know, successful in becoming illuminated and light, fully awakened in that life. In the Mahayana traditions, which start to develop about 500 years after the Buddha's birth, there's a much more kind of, you could say, mythical, magical, grandiose view of what the Buddha is, which means this also becomes the picture of what we are. So in the Buddhist way of talking about what a Buddha is, we have to understand that this is not really talking about some person who lived a long time ago and did some amazing things that we could read about. For in the Buddhist tradition, much like in the Christian tradition, much like in any religious tradition, when we talk about the people who are exemplary in that tradition, we're really talking about what we can be, what we can manifest. And we're also, particularly from the point of view of the later tradition, we're talking about what we actually are already, but we don't know it. So in the later tradition, which is known as the Mahayana, the Great Vehicle tradition, it is understood that Buddha has been a Buddha for a long, 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 long time. But even in that story, he was once an ordinary person, just like us. So either way you go, the thread to hang on to is that for all of the amazing and wondrous tales that are told about the Buddha, the awakened one, Siddhartha, Shakyamuni, Gautama, these are all his names, for all the wonderful stories that we hear about them, they are meant to be not a story of somebody amazing a long time ago and far away. They're really meant to be a kind of mirror of our own possibilities. Just as we read about biographies of inspiring figures to inspire us. Well, this is what some other person did. Why not me? Why not me? So a Buddha is born. He grows up. He has a kind of fantasy childhood and adolescence. It is predicted in various ways in custom still in India today, a young child, newborn child, particularly from a well-born family. He was born as a prince, the son of the Shakya king, a small kingdom in India, in kind of north-central India, maybe northeast, and royalty, maybe a small kingdom, but royalty. He was born to the king of the Shakyas, and that's why he gets one of his names is Shakyamuni. Muni means sage. He's a sage, the sage of the Shakyas. So still today, as was done then, when a child, particularly to a good family, is born, you go to a seer, somebody, an astrologer, somebody who can tell you what this child will be. And according to some versions of the tale, there are two apparently divergent prophecies. One is that he will become a world-ruling monarch. He will become successful in a worldly way, you could say. That's one way of interpreting that story. And in the other, he is prophesied, no, he will become a great sage, a Muni, a light of the world, someone who will teach others how to escape the predicament of human existence, the predicament of suffering that we find ourselves in. And so these two possibilities seem to be open before him. Since he comes in order to benefit the world, he is really, as it turns out, interested not so much in the world monarch thing, although that is his father's preference. And when I speak of this to my ambitious undergraduates at Rice, they often face similar conflicts, actually. Their parents want them to go into engineering, medicine, computers, and sometimes that's not exactly what they want to do. So this is an age-old tussle. Are you going to follow your heart, follow your spirit, you might say? Are you going to look for some kind of worldly success, or are these in the end not really in conflict? So the idea that there's some kind of conflict between worldly success and spiritual maturity has its heyday, you might say, during certain periods of the Buddhist tradition. Remember, Buddhism is a tradition that comes from India and then spreads all over Asia and gradually, of course, nowadays, all over the world. And in the early part of Buddhism, and what we early Buddhism, or what we now call Theravada Buddhism, is really very quickly went from India south to Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, all of these countries, India itself, it was very strong. And then in, as I said, about 500 years into the Buddha's, after the Buddha's lifetime, what is called the Mahayana, or the great tradition, develops. And in that tradition, as which is mainly the traditions that we teach about here, although these early traditions of Buddhism are absolutely foundational to the entirety of the path and practice of Buddhism, so it's not like we leave them out, but the Mahayana traditions are those that developed later in India and also went over the hills, so to speak, and down across the Silk Road and over the sea to China, Japan, Korea, Nepal, Tibet, Mongolia, later, much later, from Mongolia to Russia. These are the Mahayana traditions. And in the Mahayana tradition, the Buddha is seen as someone who, in fact, unifies and shows the way for us to unify concern with worldly things, because we have responsibilities, we especially, we're lay people, and a very, very deep anchoring axial focus on spiritual development. This is really the model of the Buddha that seems particularly relevant to us here as lay people. And we try to offer the practices that we offer in a way that in fact allows us to engage in this profound spiritual development, and at the same time bringing that to bear on our worldly activity rather than to see these in conflict. So the human predicament, as we saw last time, quoting this 18th century Tibetan version of the Buddha's life, the predicament is that we're all, in essence, naturally luminous. I read this last time. And yet, this luminosity, symbolized by the candles that we have around here, this natural luminosity that we have, to which we are ever have the possibility of awakening, right now we're dim. We have a dim unknowing. We don't see what we really are. And so we are caught. We are trapped in a snare of cycling again and again through what the Buddhists call sickly existence, cyclic, sickly existence, a cycle. And we've talked on our Teaching Tuesdays about what the cycle really is. It's not some kind of magical thinking or mythical idea that has nothing to do with us. If we look at our own lives, we see that we have repetitive patterns. How often have we said to ourselves, I've done it again. You know, I've lost my temper in exactly the way that I've done so many times before, has ruined so many moments and even relationships, and now I've done it again. I've been late again. I swore I wouldn't procrastinate, but I'm doing it. I've been pushing people away in subtle ways with my charm and good humor, but never really letting them close. For example, we all have our repetitive patterns, and this is cyclic existence. We can't get out of our patterns. We can't get out of our reactivity, and we do it again and again and again, and Western psychotherapy talks about this. Buddhism was talking about this. And if we look into how we behave in our lives, we see that we too have this sort of proclivity. And where does this come from? So in his first teaching, Buddha, having awakened too, he had some visions the night of his enlightenment. He had challenges to his awakening. And if you see the movie The Little Buddha, this is a particularly lively scene where the Maras, so-called the Maras, the demons, basically distraction. It's a very good vignette of what happens when we sit down to meditate on our breath. Well, we get distracted. So in the story of the Buddha, this distraction is expressed as a being who comes and parades his beautiful daughters in front of the Buddha further to distract him, shoots arrows at the Buddha to get him angry or fearful. But none of this changes. The Buddha just remains seated under the tree of enlightenment, a descendant of which is still today in Buddhagaya, the seat of enlightenment where Buddha became enlightened. It's a central place for Buddhist pilgrimage. And Mara then says, oh, you don't belong here. This is my place. Well, this is nothing other than some part of your mind saying, stop trying to focus. Stop trying to let go of all your stress. This is me. I own you. And in fact, our thoughts and aggressive tendencies and reactive patterns and emotions, they do own us most of the time. This is not a myth. So Mara says, I own you. You get out of here. You can't stay here. And Buddha, so I was telling Jasper, with his right hand, that's the image there, the tanka there of Buddha, is the central image, really, of the Buddhist tradition, because Mara has all of these legions. You know how one distraction comes in and then it's followed immediately by 10, 12, 100 more? The mind just goes skit, 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 skit. So Buddha, Mara, had a whole company, a whole chorus, who would chime in with him and say, yeah, you get out of here, Buddha. You don't belong here. Where this is our place. This is a place for party, not a place for meditation. Leave. You're a party pooper. And Buddha, and then they, what are you going to do? Buddha doesn't have anybody around him who can speak and defend his position. So in this famous gesture, with his right hand, he touches the earth. And the earth herself, and in some versions of this image, there's actually an earth goddess, so some feminine expression there peeking out sort of from under the ground. But he touches the earth, and the earth trembles a bit. Such is the rapport between Buddha and the environment and the support that he gets from the earth, confirming his right to be here. He is here, and he stays, and the demons vanish, and he sits, and he has some visions during the night. He sees beings dying and being born, dying and being born, endlessly, not just being born and dying, dying and being born. He sees the repetitive process of birth and death. You might prefer to understand that metaphorically in the Buddhist and Hindu traditions. This is understood as very real, and the understanding of what consciousness really is as it develops in these traditions has a very precise discussion of how it is, what it is that transmigrates. We're not going to get there today, but just want you to know it's there. And he sees also that this process, the kinds of lives that people have, the kinds of deaths that they have, isn't accidental. This is a big insight. It's not new to him. It has been part of the Indian religious genius for a time, long time already, the karmic cause and effect process, that actions that we do create effect. And that's not so far-fetched. You know that if you rag on your best friend, there's going to be some fallout from that. They're not going to want to talk to you in the same way for a while. We know that our actions have effects. So karmic theory is that actions have effects, and these effects continue, and they keep us on the chain, the cycle of cyclic existence. So in short, what Buddha understood was that, yes, we suffer because of our dim unknowing and our failure to recognize what we really are. We do suffer, but that suffering has a cause. The suffering has a cause. And just like when you go to a doctor to try to figure out why you're sneezing, is it an allergy? Is it the flu? And when you know what it is, then you know what to do. You can cure it. You can get rid of it. So this is Buddha's big message. Figure out what the cause is, and we can begin to reduce suffering. So what is the cause? One way to talk about this is the way that we walk around in our lives, and we have agendas. We have things that must happen the way we wish. And that agenda comes from a very strong kind of hanging on to what we think is and should be right. And underneath that is a very strong hanging on to ourselves, the thinker, the judger, the decider of what we think should be right. So one of the things in Buddhism that's very important is to really get a sense of what this holding, grasping is. They always say that we're grasping onto self, holding onto self. It's not so easy to understand what that means, but in other ways, it's very easy to understand. For example, imagine for a moment that we have blue skies above us in Houston, and when you look at the sky, or the ocean. Look at the sky, look at the ocean. Your mind is kind of just naturally expansive, right? This is a kind of relaxation that comes. That's why we like those things. We like to look at the vast horizon. We like to look at open land, mountains, because we just kind of go. And there's a little bit more, you could say there's a little more light in the mind. We're not kind of tightening around some object. We're just there. It's nice, you know? Then think of how your mind is when you look at your computer. Zzz, right? there's this kind of, you're magnetized by it. You're not magnetized by the sky or the ocean in the same way, right? It's nice, and you look at it, there's this kind of open view, and you feel easy. If something goes wrong, a mosquito comes by, okay. But, you know, when we're all tense and looking at the computer, and then, my God, the phone rings, who would dare to call you at such a moment? Or somebody comes in, or the air conditioning goes off, or some terrible thing occurs that interrupts your magnetic, compulsive, obsessive grasp. That's what we mean, okay? That kind of feeling. And we feel that, of course, you know, you go through a store, you see exactly the thing that you want, and your mind goes, whoosh, right, collapsing. And you see someone, you want that someone. You want them to do a particular thing, like that. So Buddha said that it's this kind of grasping that causes us difficulty. This means that in terms of practice, relaxation is very important. Learning to expand the mind is very important. And you may have noticed, I will point out again, that the practices that we do on Sundays and other practices also are very much about relaxing this tendency to grasp, to hold, to be tense in a way that actually just catapults us into more and more difficulty.
If you enjoyed this meditation, please visit our website, dawnmountain.org, to subscribe to this course and find other great Dharma offerings. May all beings always have happiness and its causes. May all beings always be free of pain and its causes.